You're listening to Office Hours, a series of curious conversations with Belfer Center experts. I sat down with Kelly Greenhill, a professor at Tufts University and author of Weapons of Mass Migration, Displacement, Coercion, and Foreign Policy, which won the 2011 International Studies Association's Best Book of the Year Award. She is also a research fellow at the Belfer Center.
You were a Scandinavian studies major.
I was.
In college.
Yes.
What was that about?
At the tail end of high school, I was an exchange student in Norway.
Okay.
And I went with AFS.
Oh, yeah.
And back in the day, before newspapers,
right.
AFS did not allow AFSers to indicate where they wanted to go. They could only identify three countries, or it might have been as many as five, where they didn't want to go, but they had to identify why. So I simply said, just don't send me anywhere where women are second-class citizens.
Okay.
So they sent me to Scandinavia. So I am not Scandinavian. I have no background historically in Scandinavia, other than that I wanted to be someplace where I could spread my wings.
And AFS has summer programs. They have year-long programs.
So I was there for the whole year.
You were the whole year? Oh, this was a high school.
So I had effectively two final years of high school.
Wow.
And so I graduated in the United States, and then I graduated in Norway. And having learned Norwegian while spending the year in school in Norway, I figured it was a fine second major since I had already fulfilled the language requirement.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Does that feature, does Scandinavian studies or Norway feature in any of your interests now? Seems like it's a lot more Middle East oriented, Africa oriented.
Well, I guess there are Scandinavian peacekeepers, so in terms of military intervention, but that's a bit of a stretch. What I can tell you is that while some people say, why did you learn Norwegian? It's not the most useful of languages. It was remarkably useful when I was working on a project on Bosnia, because there were a number of refugees from the Bosnian War who ended up living in Norway. Mm-hmm. And while my Serbo-Croatian is poor, my Norwegian is quite good.
Right.
And so we had a common language. So I was able to conduct a fair number of interviews of Bosnians.
You were in Bosnia.
I did spend time in Bosnia, but then I also interviewed Bosnian refugees who were living in Norway, as well as other places.
How do you keep up Norwegian now? Do you have a...
Still keep in touch with people there, the ones who will talk to me.
Did you alienate some folks?
Not so far as I know, but perhaps you might want to, make some inquiries. So I still have friends and surrogate family there. Now and again, Norwegians end up in Belfer, so I take advantage. Actually, there's a postdoc or pre-doc / postdoc across the hall over in Brattle who is Norwegian.
Is that Niels?
It's Matthias.
Oh, Matthias, okay.
So sometimes I coerce people to speak in Norwegian with me.
So I want to talk about migration.
Yes.
You have a book, you wrote a book called Weapons of Mass Migration.
Yes.
Which won the 2011 International Studies Association Book of the Year. And you talk about using people as weapons. But I have to confess, when I think about using a human being as a weapon, I sort of think, because it gets me a little confused, is it something like sending Chuck Norris into the Middle East to clean it up? Or how can human beings be weapons? How are they used as weapons?
Potential target states are often quite reluctant to bear the burdens associated with absorbing large numbers of migrants and or refugees. So one can think of people as, though it's uncomfortable to do so, one can think of humans as demographic bombs. And so in the same way that adversaries can lob dumb bombs or use smart weapons against their adversaries, they can also threaten to send large numbers of people to create problems inside potential recipient states.
But they're not forced. I mean, are they forcing those people, or is it something?
It depends on
those people already want to go, and they're just letting them through.
It depends. So, in the case of Cuba, Fidel Castro, during his time as leader, used this tool against the United States on three different occasions. And in the case of Cuba, people are historically quite eager to leave. So it's simply a matter of him opening the floodgates and essentially saying, you're now permitted to leave. and the rest takes care of itself. In other cases, people do have to or have been compelled to leave using force or the threat of force.
Do threats like that work?
Distressingly often.
Really?
About 3/4 of the, say, I've identified at least 75 cases of this kind of coercion having been attempted since the advent of the 1951 Refugee Convention alone. There are another 10 cases that are suggestive, but I'm not 100% certain that they're real cases. But so of the 75 cases that I'm sure of, this form of coercion has gotten the coercers at least some of what they've sought in about 3/4 of the cases, so 75% of the time, more or less. If one imposes a more stringent measure, such as did the coercer get all of what he or she was after, the success rate goes down to about 57%. Hmm. But lest you think that's a little better than a coin toss, it's worth keeping in mind that the U.S.'s own record in the context of coercive diplomacy, best case estimates are somewhere around 37.5%. So 57% is actually a pretty significant success.
So it's a very effective tool.
It's a very effective tool when employed. So wearing my social science scientist hat, I can say it might still be a pretty lousy method of coercion because perhaps it's only deployed when the coercer would be coercers pretty sure it's going to work.
Yeah, we only see it when
it's... Right. So I can't tell you anything about the number of cases where the dog didn't bark. I also can't tell you for certain that the 75 to 85 cases that I've identified represents the universe of cases, because this tends to be a self-hiding phenomenon.
How do we even know when it's been averted? Is it possible?
Well, sometimes we know because people talk, but quite often it's difficult to know. One thing I can say is that my intuition or my suspicion is that the actual number of cases is, say, at least somewhat higher than the number I've identified, because whenever I talk about this phenomenon with people who are area experts or members of various militaries, they say, oh, well, you know, do you talk about X case? Yeah. And sometimes I know about X case, but more often than not, I haven't heard of. Maybe that's less true since I finished the book, but for a very long time, new cases would pop up all the time. And they weren't recorded, per se, in obvious places, but in order to make it into the data set, I had to corroborate that they were real.
How does even one make sure that this other state accepts those people? Mm-hmm. I mean, you talk about lobbying human bombs or demographic bombs, but you can't force another state to just accept them, can you? I mean, you can't just fly a plane with a bunch of people in it or send a bus over. No, they have borders. They have sort of processes and stuff in place to protect against that.
Well, not all borders are militarized. So moving to area... pushing people across in buses has, in fact, worked on some occasions. But also, quite often, target states are liberal democracies who are legally and normatively bound, obligated, inclined to at least accept those who would be granted asylum were they to apply for refugee status and be accepted. In circumstances where large-scale humanitarian disasters have been created, there are certainly exceptions that maybe prove the rule, but quite often states have been willing to take in a reasonably large number of people, at least treat them as temporary, give them temporary protected status, and then figure out who's deserving of asylum later. However, while this may be palatable to national leaders, it is often deeply unpalatable to certain segments of society or to local leaders. So in the midst of one of the aforementioned Cuban migration crises, while President Clinton said, sure, open the ports, we're happy to take as many Cubans as you'll send, Governor Lawton Chiles in Florida had a very different idea, and he said, no, they're not going to arrive here. We're going to send them back. Or if you want these people here, you can resettle them elsewhere in the United States. So this creates at a minimum, tensions, and in many cases, outright significant political fights within potential target states, which can make acquiescing to coercers' demands all that more attractive, even if targets of this kind of coercion would, left to their own devices, not wish to right. to concede.
Do we accept refugees because we have big hearts, or do we do it because we're afraid of the consequences that would happen if the refugees had nowhere to go?
I think it depends on who we refers to. So some people believe very deeply and firmly in humanitarian principles and in international law that says we should protect those who are deserving of or fleeing right. violence, privation, and persecution. And there are others who think we should protect refugees, those who feel compelled to leave for other reasons because it's in our own self-interest. We might be concerned that they'll become radicalized if we don't accept them, just as a for instance, or we don't know what might happen to them or what they might do if we don't accept them. That said, there are many, and arguably in some places an increasingly large segment of societies or increasing numbers of people who simply say we shouldn't take any more people.
Do they get radicalized? Is there a, when the United States says, no, we're not going to accept any, or an X number of Syrians, and a lot of people get turned away?
I would be careful about drawing a direct causal link, yeah. but it's fair to say that we know that people who end up in refugee camps and another or displaced persons camps for long periods of time in highly problematic or, say, poor conditions can become radicalized. Whether they've become radicalized because they weren't granted asylum, or they've just become radicalized because they're in an environment that is conducive to that, I wouldn't, you know, there are many pathways, and many pathways to potential radicalization, and also many people who are in these conditions who don't become radicalized. So it would be overly simplistic to simply say, mm-hmm. yes, if we don't accept them, they become radicalized. But leaving vulnerable people in situations of deprivation and poor conditions and inhumane conditions for extended period of time can lead to all sorts of unfortunate outcomes, from a humanitarian perspective, mm-hmm. from a security perspective, and there's a whole raft of other potential problems, both for the people themselves and for the host states.
What would a world look like without borders? Would that be just complete chaos? And what would actually happen?
Well, even if I started in a world without newspapers, the Westphalian system was firmly in place. I'm happy to sort of entertain this thought experiment, but I don't see such a world arising anytime soon. Nationalism and other forms of identity politics have long been powerful. We stopped talking about them in some circles for a while, but they're back with a vengeance. And so I can speculate about what a borderless world would look like, but I don't think we're going to see one anytime soon.
I mean, if we yeah. loosen our borders mm-hmm. a ton.
Yes.
I think that's the concern. Mm-hmm. If we loosen our borders, or how much do we loosen our borders? Mm-hmm. And we don't have to maybe keep them totally open. But if we open them a ton, mm-hmm. what would happen? Would it really, in what ways does it strain a country to just have a huge inflow of people? In what ways is it beneficial?
So we do know that over the medium and long term, that even large inflows of people tend to have a small net benefit, or represent a small net benefit to a country's economy, or have no discernible effect whatsoever. So over the long term, there are no real problems with respect to economics. In countries that are suffering declining birth rates and have aging populations.
Like Europe.
Broad swaths of Europe. There are all sorts of reasons to imagine that a population influx could actually be not simply
Teach some young people in there, right?
Yes, just right. A bunch of build up the tax base. Right. Create a new employment pool from some of these people who are coming are, in fact, highly educated. So this could be good for countries in all sorts of ways. However, in the short term, there are adjustment costs. When large numbers of people show up in an unregulated way, who don't, they don't speak the language, they don't have resources, there are real stresses placed on the societies that are hosting them. So there aren't camps sitting around in countries just waiting for large numbers of people to flow into them. So there are real stresses and strains. There are also questions and concerns raised by people in some countries about how culture, society, mores, norms, all of these things change with influxes of people.
Right.
I personally don't find this deeply problematic.
We have international obligations to recognize refugees and to give them a process of incorporating them into our country. Or the states who have signed on. Is this a universal treaty, or is it something that was just a few select countries, or was it the 1951
Refugee Convention? Yeah. So states have to become signatories, decide to sign on, and then the treaty has to be ratified for it to come into force.
How many countries have ratified it?
I think the number is 147, but...
Pretty good?
To say the vast majority.
Right.
That number might not be exactly right, but say it is the vast majority of states in the international system that have signed on. However, there's a few wrinkles. The definition of refugee is very specific and relatively narrow. So many of the people who are fleeing, quite reasonably fleeing generalized violence, war, deprivation, are not legally entitled to refugee status, because Refugee Convention has a very specific definition of who is entitled to refugee status.
Does that create problems? Is that where you're going with this?
It can create problems, but also it limits states' obligations in terms of the Refugee Convention, because it doesn't say we agree to not return anybody whose life is generally in danger or people who are in dire life circumstances because we signed the Refugee Convention.
Right.
They have very specific obligations. And on top of that, while states who have signed on to the Refugee Convention are legally bound not to what is called refoul, or to send those entitled to refugee protection back to the country of origin or to the borders of the country of origin, states have not correspondingly universally embraced a right to asylum. So there's a right to seek asylum.
there's a right to
be granted asylum. There is not a fundamental obligation of states to grant asylum.
You just have to. So states are obligated to do what then?
They're obligated to protect those who are entitled to refugee. But your sense that there's something
wrong here.
Kinky here, or
is it,
that
like
there's a fundamental tension, it, is correct.
It feels like
yes.
States are saying, we really believe in this in principle, and then when it actually happens, they're like, shit. I don't know if that really counts. That's not really. Is that a fair?
Well, the states believe it in principle. They may even believe it in practice. But they also, first and foremost, have an obligation to protect their own citizenry. And there are limits to how much unregulated immigration states are willing, how many of these costs they're willing to bear, and how many people they're willing to take in. And international law also says that they are allowed to protect themselves against threats to national security. In addition, when the Refugee Convention was originally conceived and came into force, the expectation was that we were talking about European refugees and that this would be a relatively short-term problem. The convention then became a very effective tool in the context, propaganda tool, in the context of the Cold War, because Western states could claim that they were willing to take in all of those sure. who were willing to vote with their feet, who wanted to flee persecution from behind the Iron Curtain. But of course, because there was an Iron Curtain, the number of people who could actually take advantage of these expansive promises was small. And so it was a self-limiting issue.
That's clever.
Yeah. So, and, yes. And in the end, it became too clever by half.
But how many refugees who are seeking, not just displaced, mm-hmm. so displaced refers to those who are within country.
So displaced people is both internal and external. Okay. But internally displaced people, sort of IDPs, are those who are displaced within their country of nationality or country.
And refugees are people who are externally displaced. Is that
people
correct?
People who are externally displaced, if they're called... refugee gets used loosely, okay. but...
How many are there a
year?
So
there could be... there's refugees, there's asylum seekers, yes. those who are presumptive refugees.
If we're bundling yes. all that together.
Right now, we have... According to UNHCR, there are at least 60.5 million people displaced
every year.
The world. No. I mean, it's the stock figure. Yes, it's probably a bit higher now because this figure's from about 12 months ago.
Yeah. Just thinking about that number.
Number of refugees is about 1/3 of that number.
Number of refugees. Yeah. So 60 million
and,
people.
About 5 million of those. Of that sort of 19-20 million are Palestinians who don't count in the.
Right.
They count for sure, but they don't count in the number of UNHCR refugees because they're under their own mandate.
Which is the country in the world that deals with these issues the best?
Historically, Sweden would have been an excellent choice. Sweden's been remarkably welcoming, and I happen to speak the language.
Are you planning on something? Is that what's going on?
Sweden's been on a per capita basis has. Welcomed in as sort of permanent asylum seekers more than practically any other country on the
planet. Per capita, or are you just in
Per capita, but yeah. I mean significantly large numbers, period, but on a per capita basis.
And they don't have to do that. They're just...
They've been very nice. Welcoming and have resettled an enormous number. And they did so after the Iraq War, and they've also resettled a large number of Syrians, and even earlier... A fair number of asylum seekers from Southeast Asia and South Asia. Sweden's been very welcoming. There are reasons to believe that Sweden will have to change its or may change its policies going forward, just because even Sweden's beginning to feel the strain of having been so welcoming.
How important are walls? Are they plausible in some scenarios? Can people?
Well, they are very popular, increasingly popular.
In rhetoric or in actual practice?
Both in rhetoric and
so
in
people
practice.
Are building walls.
Yes, people are building walls.
Is Mexico paying for all of them? That's the question.
Mexico is not paying for any of them.
Okay.
And I would refer you back to the John Oliver segment that
okay.
He should pay me royalties.
He should, shouldn't he?
Walls alone... Well, it depends where they're placed. So trying to put a wall along the southern U.S. border is a fool's errand. It would be quite costly and ineffective. There are places where borders are smaller and easier to police. Some barriers can be effective and have been effective.
Yeah.
Generally not by themselves.
What do you need in addition to a wall? So a wall is not going to keep out people.
Need to be militarized quite often. Or it needs to be really...
Surveillance? You need to have
surveillance,
cameras, et cetera.
Border patrols. One can make it impossible to actually reach the wall.
If the wall is tall enough, who's going to get over it, right?
John Oliver says, if Donald Trump wants to build a wall that's 30 feet high, I see an uptick in the number of ladders that are 31 feet high. So... If you can get to the wall and no one's going to stop you, you can get over the other side. But that's not always the case.
This is a thought experiment.
And the Berlin Wall.
Right. That wasn't even that tall.
So walls can be effective.
It was pretty thin too, right? It was only right that much.
So it was more the people who were policing that wall.
Right. Yeah, you would get shot. Yes. There's also barbed wire and other sorts of things that were...
Right, so the wall slowed people down enough that other actions could be taken.
I've been hearing a lot of talk about this idea. They call it R2P.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just the new character in the Star Wars franchise? Who is that? Who is R2P?
This is going to be a major conversation at dinner tonight. Yes, R2P stands for the responsibility to protect. It was brainchild of Gareth Evans and a few other idea entrepreneurs who were deeply distressed at the failure of the international community to take action to... in the lead up to mass atrocities and genocide. It was taken up and expanded upon and, if you will, kind of, it's an emerging norm. It was an emerging norm that may now be hibernating in the aftermath of what happened in Libya. R2P was used as, depending on who you ask, either a justification or a pretext for the 2011...
What do you think?
Somewhere in between.
Yeah.
I think it depends on the actor.
But why would we have wanted to get involved there anyway, if it wasn't for that?
How much time do we have?
Okay, maybe she's getting...
the reasons that the Europeans were eager to see Gaddafi removed are not wholly unrelated to discussions of migration. So Gaddafi had successfully used threat of mass migration against the Europeans in 2004, in 2006, in 2008, in 2010, when he famously threatened to turn Europe black, if not given
billions
of euros.
Let those boats flow through the Mediterranean,
just let them come.
Get to Europe.
Before he...
Europe didn't want to turn black.
Europe did not want to turn black, okay. But it also was... some of these European leaders were quite tired of Gaddafi, shall we say, serially blackmailing.
And so they were paying him off.
Yes.
Is that what was
going on?
So
in 2004, initially the last of the sanctions were lifted against Libya in exchange for the forging of an agreement that Libya would... curtail movements across the Mediterranean. Some financial benefits were also forthcoming. After that, he asked for money and equipment and more money and more money and more money until 2011, when the protests in Libya that were part and parcel of the Arab Spring broke out. Gaddafi called EU ministers to Tripoli and demanded that the EU cease support for the democracy movement, or else he was going to flood Europe. That was a big mistake.
So people don't talk about this with respect to Libya.
Some people do, but by and large, they talk much more often about his threat to massacre people in Misrata. So I'm not to do not walk. One should not walk away with the misapprehension that I'm saying. It was simply that they got tired of him blackmailing them. But
gotcha.
It was certainly true that they had gotten tired of him, of Gaddafi blackmailing them.
And
when he threatened to massacre his people, Gaddafi had few or no friends in the region. And what was initially promised was that the intervention was going to be limited to preventing mass atrocities. That's obviously not what happened.
R2P can blend into, and that's the issue, the mission creep.
To mission creep, and also the Russians and the Chinese have at least publicly said that they believe that they were fundamentally misled in that it was always the intention of some of the other members of the UN to unseat and depose Gaddafi, but that's not what they signed up for. Depending on who you ask, that's
so R2P
disingenuous
is kind of taking a backseat right now to other...
Well, if R2P was, in fact, a truly emerging norm, then we might arguably see very different behavior in Syria as well as other parts of the world where much larger numbers of people have been targeted, where there have been, where actually have been mass atrocities committed, as opposed to simply possibly blustering assertions made about what might happen in Libya. Which is not to say he may well have been in earnest, but we'll never know.
You're working on a project now, a book project, mm-hmm. on rumors and myths and conspiracy theories mm-hmm. and their effect on foreign policy. Mm-hmm. You're not a conspiracy theorist.
I'm not a conspiracy theorist myself, no. It may sound odd, but this book is actually an outgrowth of my last two books. So, my last two books, two of my previous books. The migration book doing research for the migration book made very clear to me how threats often have little to do with the objective security environment, or what people view as scary.
What do you mean?
Well, we talked before about it doesn't take large numbers of people to make people within recipient states afraid. Mm-hmm. It's just the idea of what might happen, the other, the outsider.
So starting rumors, propaganda, kind of making them think that
conspiracy theories deception. About outsiders.
Is that the same as a conspiracy theory, though? Is that it seems?
Well, so. The migration book made very clear that there can be a fundamental disconnect between what is objectively measurable and what people are actually afraid of.
Right.
And rumors, conspiracy theories, propaganda, all of these pieces of information, which I collectively call extra-factual information, can feed into uncertainty.
Exacerbate the fear.
Yeah. Where people are getting their data not from facts, not from things they can measure, not verifiable threats, but rather inchoate, intangible things that fundamentally make them afraid. And they're outside actors, you can call them merchants of menace, if you will, who will instrumentally manipulate these fears and draw upon rumors, conspiracy theories. Think of Donald Trump's rhetoric to talk about what might be possible, what they should be afraid of. Doesn't matter if that's actually what they should be afraid of. It's what enterprise actors can make them, can feed, and capitalize on these fears. So that was rolling around in the back of my head. Mm. I also co-authored and co-edited a book on the politicization of crime and conflict statistics called Sex, Drugs, and Body Counts. And working on that book made it very clear to me how the self-conscious misrepresentation of information for political and military ends can be and has been extraordinarily effective.
Are you studying lies too? Kennedy just lies and tells a lie, like, is that the same
lies
as capitalizing
on
a rumor?
Lies can be an extreme version. So people can spread rumors they know are not true to great effect. They can also spread rumors they think are plausibly true. And it matters less whether the spreader believes it, but if he or she believes, other people will believe it.
Did you have to take a lot of psychology? Do you have to read a lot of psychology to learn about these things?
Coincidentally, maybe it's just the way my brain was wired. I attended the Stanford Institute on Political Psychology as soon as I finished graduate school because I didn't study political psychology in graduate school. It was just something. It was a hole in my graduate school knowledge. Okay. I figured, I should learn about this.
So seems important.
I did get some training. It then sort of sat in the back of my mind or the back shelf till I began working on this project. So yes, lies are in there, so are unverified pieces of information that turn out to be true.
Right.
So some rumors are true. Some conspiracy theories just turn out to be conspiracies. The focus of the book is on how often and how significant a range of circumstances this information, though it is unverified at the time of transmission, has affected foreign and defense policy in a wide array of contexts. And the book looks at cases from pre-World War I Britain up to post 9/11 mm-hmm. America.
Very cool. Yeah. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
This was really, really great. Office Hours was produced by the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.